Today's Equinox Summit public lecture features Professor Václav Smil on energy transitions. Václav Smil is a distinguished professor at the University of Manitoba and the author of more than 30 books. Most recently, Prime Movers of Globalization, The History and Impact of Diesel Engines and Gas Turbines. He's currently working on a book about manufacturing in America. His interdisciplinary research encompasses energy, environment, food, population, economics, history, and public policy studies. I could go on because the man is infinitely curious. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and has lectured widely in North America, Europe, and Asia. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Smil. Thank you.
Glad to be here. Those of you who've seen me performing before, you know that I have no idea where I'll be in 30 minutes. This is an old-fashioned lecture. I will stick to the topic, but it's a giant topic. We could spend 2 days or 2 months with it. I always hate to do these things at the beginning, but in this case, I have to do it. What is it I'll be talking about? When I say energy transitions, what do you imagine? I know what most people imagine. Most people think these are these bad, terrible fossil fuels. We've been told these horrible things about them. You burn them and they generate carbon and, you know, carbon dioxide puffs out and that destroys the planet and global warming will kill us all and they are dirty and they are ugly and we should move to this nirvana of green renewables, sunshines and wind blows. So that's what you think is energy transition. And yes, indeed, that's what most people think it is, and I'll be talking about that. But I'll be talking a lot more about a lot other things. For example, in my basement, it being Canada and me living in Winnipeg, I have a furnace, which, it being Canada, is fueled by natural gas. But that furnace which I have is unlike the furnace which most Canadians have. It's 97% efficient, that furnace. When we came to Canada from the US in 1972, there was no such furnace. Typical furnaces at the time were, the bad ones were like 50%, 55%, 60%. Then we got better and better. And now most of the building codes mean that in Canada you have to have what we call the mid-efficiency furnace, which fortunately is not mid, it's not 50, but it's more like 70%, a little bit over 68, 74%. Okay, so that's what you have to have, because it costs about half as much or 60% as much as the one which I have. So most people have those as opposed to the one I have. Imagine if entire Canada would make an energy transition from mid-efficiency furnaces to high-efficiency furnaces. Say 97 divided by 72. You see that? We would be gaining nearly 40%. We would have to consume 40% less natural gas in the whole country. And it could be done like that, because you know very well, those of you who have the furnace, they don't last forever. They last for 10, 11, 12, some 15 years, so 12 years. So if we would put the policy in place 12 years ago that everybody has to have high efficiency furnace, because they've been available for more than 20 years now, everybody in Canada would have a 97% furnace, and all Canada would be producing 40% less carbon dioxide from burning natural gas. Just like that. Just like that, right? There is no renewable energy which will get you 40% less of carbon in 20 years on a scale like that. 34 million people, more than 10 million households. Just simple like that. Nobody of you thinks about energy transition as changing one furnace for another furnace. A technique which is old, well known, easily available, readily you can buy, just you, you know, you call your contractor and they'll install it whatever next morning or next afternoon. Now also energy transition as far as the prime movers are concerned. Our society is run by all kinds of prime movers, by engines, by motors. Electric motor is a great prime mover. Diesel engine is another one. Think of that. In this country, you fundamentally, you don't find a diesel car. Oh, there are these huge German models, but that's nothing. In most European countries, diesels are 40, 50, 60, 70% of newly sold cars. Those of you who know kindergarten engineering, which I suppose in this room is 98% of people, you know that diesel is inherently 35 to 40% more efficient than the ancient auto engine. Why don't we have half of the diesels in Canada? Diesels of today are not like diesels. The first diesel car was 1930s Mercedes-Benz. It's not like that. They are, you know, they are clean. They are super efficient. They are reliable. They are like anything else. Why don't we have them? If we would have them, our consumption of gasoline in this country, I mean, we would be consuming diesel fuel, so our consumption of liquid refined fuels would be significantly less, and we could do what? Because you still have to refine crude oil, and you would have that gasoline, so we could sell that gasoline to whatever, to Iranians. Iranians are always short of gasoline, right? Because they don't have enough refining capacity. So, you know, why haven't we made a transition which is easy to make, which European countries made by millions of copies, at least having like 30, 40, 50% of diesel cars? There is no godly reason, engineering or environmental, because these new deals are super clean to have. You could also think about energy transitions in terms of per capita energy consumption. Why do we in Canada, and of course this goes in together because we have bad furnaces and we have bad cars, so we consume so much. Why do we in Canada have to consume twice as much energy per capita as people consume in France and Germany? Why don't we make a transition to more sensible level of consumption? We could talk about transition in terms of travel, right? Whenever I come to Toronto, I shudder. This is just mind-boggling, right? This is a city of close to 6 million people, and you cannot get from airport to downtown by any rapid train link. This is totally medieval, right? You have to have a bus or taxi, individual or limo or whatever, right? What is even, you know, I mean, I'm at loss here. I can't verbalize here because we actually make those trains. There is a company called Bombardier in Quebec, which is making the rapid trains for Europeans, right? So in Europe, when you want to have a rapid train, you order it. I mean, there are many European makers, but you can order it from Bombardier. Now, the best example, of course, is this. Forget about going from, you know, airport to downtown. That's nothing. How about the fact that every hour there is a rapid air jetliner flying from Toronto to Ottawa, from Toronto to Montreal, instead of having a high-speed train between Toronto and Montreal? We have the, after Norwegians, we have the most abundant and cheapest hydroelectricity in all affluent world, right? Yet we do not have a single high-speed link, even in this area of high population corridor between Montreal and Toronto. It's absolutely incredible. So you've got to get to the airport, that's 1.5 hour before, wait 1 hour there, then to take 1 hour flight downtown to downtown. We were in Valencia in February, and the King Carlos of Spain opened the latest European high-speed link just last December. So we rode the train when it was literally 2 months old between Valencia and Madrid. You sit there, and of course they got it from Japanese. Japanese came up with the Shinkansen. You have this little speed indicator, so you could see from wherever you sit in the car, and the train goes, just picks up slowly, right? And then it goes 290, 297, 300, 303 kilometers, zing, 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 right? You know, 300 kilometers. You know how fast the fastest, well, you cannot even say that. There is no fastest Canadian train. There are no trains really of that kind, really. But generally, the trains which we have, they go about 85 kilometers per hour. Okay? So we definitely live in middle age. And as I say, you know, we make the trains, and we have the just about the world cheapest hydroelectricity. And you know, so how about you make a transition from limos and buses to rapid trains, really, right? Anyway, you don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear about furnaces in the basement. You don't want to hear about rapid trains. You want to came to hear. You want me to say that future is bright and green and full of photovoltaics and wind and stinky fossil fuels should be banned. And okay, I will not say that because we are what we are. We are fundamentally fossil fuel civilization. Everything you see around us, we have fossil fuels to thank for. Everything, even the things which you don't think about. Next time when you see that beautiful tall mast, this tall tower and the tall tower, these three big blades, whoosh, whoosh, go like that, right? What you are looking at is what? Pure expression of fossil fuels, nothing else. What is that tower? It's steel. How is steel made? Well, you decarbonize iron. How is iron made? Well, you dig up iron ore. How do you dig up iron ore? Well, you get some big two steel machines, which dig up that ore, then you put it into big bulk ships, which transport it from Brazil to China, because we get so much of our steel from China these days, or you import it to Hamilton. Then you have to mine lots of coal, which is more steel machine with big teeth mining that coal, or big surface excavators getting that coal. You get high quality coal, and you make coke out of it, right? And then you mine lots of limestone, and you throw in together iron ore and limestone and coke, and you smelt your pig iron, and then you make steel out of it, and then you make a nice tower, and then you put these beautiful blades. And what are these blades? Well, you drill for oil or natural gas in Alberta or Texas, and you made plastics out of it, right? So when you look next time at a wind turbine, it's a pure embodiment of powerful fossil fuels, okay? When you look at solar cells, even more so, because making silicon, those who you know how it's made, making ultra pure quality silicon, you know, this is not like making glass. Making glass is 5 gigajoules per ton. You cannot make a ton of silicon with 5 gigajoules of energy investment, right? Making good steel, 15, 20, super steel, you make it 30 gigajoules per ton, right? Once you get into fancy stuff, aluminum is 200 gigajoules per ton, titanium, no? Well, it's more like 2 terajoules per ton. Once you get to this fancy stuff, very high, all these rare earths and all these things, very, very high embodied energy. So when you look at your cell phone, right, your cell phone actually is very light, right? But in terms of embodied energy, it's like 1/4 of your car, because most of your car is just steel, right? Whatever, you know, 20 gigajoules per ton. But most of your stuff which goes into your cell phone is hundreds and hundreds of gigajoules per ton. So, you know, there is no thing which is not fossil fuel thing. Food which you eat is totally fossil fuel thing. A tractor which plow the field is burning diesel fuel, and it's made of steel and rubber and plastics. And this is not the most important thing. Most important thing is what you dump on that field so you get a high yield. And that's ammonia fertilizer or any other nitrogen fertilizer, which always starts with ammonia made by Haber-Bosch process. What is a Haber-Bosch process? Well, you get lots of natural gas and you compress it a great deal and you get even more natural gas and you rip it apart so you get hydrogen, and because you get nitrogen from freezing it from the air. That's an easy part, right? So you get nitrogen and under high pressure, then you get NH3 out of it. So what you are eating is just pure fossil fuel. I have no idea how we will make ammonia. We are making about 140 million tons of it globally a year. I don't know how we make it from something green, something somewhere, right? Same with coal. We are now smelting 1 billion ton of iron every year. 1 billion ton of iron. Takes lots of coke. The only other alternative is what? Well, charcoal, right? You do your calculations. You can go on my website. There is a little paper there. There's lots of little papers. But one of them is about how to produce world reducing requirement for iron from charcoal. Well, you just simply devote half of Amazon to fast-growing eucalyptus plantations. That will give you enough of charcoal for the whole world. This is not easily done because we are restricted by power densities. You cannot grow, you know, high power density trees. Trees are, for us, it's an inherently inefficient process. So you can harvest only as much as you can harvest. 10 tons per hectare, 15 tons per hectare of biomass. You cannot harvest, you know, 100 tons per hectare. We are working on it, because eventually we will, quote unquote, run out. But the term run out, this would be a, you know, good subject for like, you know, 10 lectures. The term running out, which we hear all the time, is one which to a scientist is like, you know, you don't want to hear it. It just doesn't make any sense. Physically, of course, it's nonsense. We will never run out of any resource. Long before it will become physically unavailable, it becomes so bloody expensive that we don't even bother to look at it even, okay? As the famous saying says, you know, the Neolithic era didn't end because we ran out of stones, right? And wooden era didn't end up, we didn't turn to coal and oil gas because we ran out of wood, really, right? So we will never run out this idea, you know, running out peak oil and we are running out of oil. We are not running out of anything on a human scale, right? Which actually, you know, I should take a detour now and tell you the story, which is a fascinating story, and it's kind of a multi-level story, and it will return us to this transition because it carries a very, very deep lesson. this is a learned audience. So there were these two guys in 1852. One was James Prescott, last name. Joule, right? That's the guy whom we honor by calling the energy unit, which is not the same as power, which I always find in my lectures that most people, even with serious degrees, do not know the difference between energy and power and think they are the same, but they are not. But I leave it to your private study, those of you who are uncertain about the difference between energy and power. So James Prescott Joule and the guy called Bill Thompson, later known as Lord Kelvin, they discovered that when you compress gas mightily and let it through a nozzle, it will expand and cool. Wow, very simple, but very powerful, right? This is how we started to get really cold stuff. But you know, it was expensive to do. Compression was expensive. Anything with pressure was expensive. 1870s, 1880s. We didn't have metals. We didn't have any plastics. We didn't have metals to do it, you know. So it took us until 1890s, 1895, Carl von Linde patented what we now do all the time, freezing stuff out of the air. You just simply liquefy the air and, you know, separate the oxygen, nitrogen, whatever you want out of it, really. So we got a concept, the idea, how to freeze the stuff, theoretically, in 1852. We got the commercial freezing out of things, individual elements out of the air by 1895. An American engineer actually took a patent in 1915, how to freeze methane and put it on a ship and make a liquefied natural gas tanker. But 1915, hell, there were no high-pressure pipelines. U.S. was the only country which was using a little bit of natural gas. Everybody was still running on wood or coal. Let me make a little detour here and ask you, when was the time when we actually switched the transition, 50%, tip of point, from wood to coal? In the United States, in 1884, until 1884, the United States was predominantly wooden society. Globally, about 1905. In Japan, about the same time. In Russia, about 1930. Russia was wooden society until 1930. In China, only in late 1960s. China was wood and straw society until late 1960s. India, late 1970s, right? So these tipping points are very recent. You always hear that 19th century was century of coal. Now, what I told you, you know better. 19th century globally was a century of wood, right? From 1800 to 1899, most of energy burned in the world was wood, charcoal, and straw. Right? 20th century, interestingly enough, is not a century of oil. 20th century, if you do integration for 20th century, was the century of coal. Only the latter half of the 20th century was the 50 years of oil. But the first 50 years was so much more coal that the whole century was actually a century of coal. Right? So in 1915, there was still coal, plenty of wood, you know, a little bit of oil in US, a little bit of oil in Russia. Nobody cared about natural gas. So that patent slept for decades. Then in late 1930s, in few places in US, they actually liquefied natural gas in small amounts to use it for the peaking. And you need peak electricity generation, so it's a nice storage, small storage. Right? Few places, nothing to it. After the war, what happened? Surplus tankers, T2 tankers from the Second World War. There was no end of T2 tankers. You could buy a T2 tanker for nothing. This is what Ari Onassis done and became a zillionaire and married Jackie. That's the story, right? Without surplus T2 tankers, he wouldn't become a billionaire. He would never marry Jackie in 20 years later. So, and oil was cheap. Oil was $1.50 a barrel. And $1.50 a barrel in 48, and $1.50 a barrel in 55, and $1.50 a barrel in 1960. It never was more expensive, right? So everybody was just shoving oil around in these tankers and building bigger and bigger tankers. Who cared about, you know, shoving around liquefied natural gas? But England was not running out of coal, but England was running out of easy coal. Because, you know, it's not an easy coal when you have to go a mile down deep, right, and dig it up in a seam which is like 25 centimeters thick. Right? There's lots of that coal there. England is sitting on zillions of tons of coal. Zillion meaning actually billions, right? But it's just too expensive. So by late 1950s, England was saying, well, you know, maybe we should bring this cheap natural gas from Algeria, because Algerians in Hassermel in Sahara, they discovered a tremendous super giant field of natural gas. So in 59, they ran a trial run from Lake Charles, Louisiana to Canvey Island in England, little liquefied natural gas mini tanker. And it worked. And so they put it in place. They built a liquefaction factory in Algeria and a deliquefaction factory in England and just, you know, started to shove the gas in 1964. Because lo and behold, of course, they didn't know that within a few years they'll discover supergiant gas field in the North Sea. And they did, so boom, there it went. Right? French did a little bit from Libya, but you know, then North Sea came, so they forgot it. So the only people who actually were shoving natural gas, liquefied natural gas in some quantity were Japanese from Alaska to Tokyo, starting in 1969. And so Japanese were the only people bringing it in, you know, 70s and 80s, and then only 90s they were joined by South Korea, Taiwan. But the tankers were relatively small because Japanese had a limit on the size of tankers for the safety reasons, and they were the main partner in all of this. And there was no free trade in this gas. People were tied to long-term contracts. You go to Malaysia, you tell them, I will bring, you know, for 20 years from Malaysia to Japan. Or you go to whatever, Indonesia then, so on. Only in 1990s it started to change, and it was because of Qatar, because Qatar has much more natural gas than crude oil. And so Qatar said, we'll go a big way, and we'll make it in a global fuel. We'll build bigger tankers, and now there are tankers, you know, the flex class and super class, which are like, you know, giant oil tankers, 250,000 tons, 250,000 ton natural gas tanker. We changed the storage. Instead of aluminum globes, we basically fill the whole tanker. We make a, you know, steel structure and insulate, including some whatever, you know, just plywood. It's very simple, but all you need is minus 160 degrees Celsius. At minus 162 Celsius, methane becomes nicely liquefied. So because the sizes increased and the supply increased, there are now, you know, 20 countries which will sell you a liquefied natural gas. Liquefied natural gas finally became a global fuel. You could order it from anywhere, basically, or not anywhere, but from these many suppliers and ship it anywhere, right? So there you have a transition to natural gas as a global fuel, because oil was always easy to move in a tanker, which took basically from 1852 to 2000, right? From the theoretical concept to the practical liquefaction in 1895, to the first trial run of a tanker in 1959, to mass tankers and mass deployment. So the tankers now carry about, you know, 20-25% of the global natural gas trade by year 2010. But, and this is another lesson, so you see the first lesson is obviously these energy transitions to higher quality fuels, from coal to oil to natural gas in this case, they take very, very long time. And when you finally get there, you may be busted. Because you know what happened in the past 10 years. Right? What happened is the shale gas. Right? So Americans were gearing up 10 years ago, saying, oh, we'll have to build one in Louisiana, one in South Carolina, more in Massachusetts, because we'll be bringing so much liquefied natural gas, because we are running out of natural gas, right? People always, there's nothing more frightening than the running out of things, right? They were not running out of natural gas at all. They were just simply running out of easily accessible, old, classic natural gas, a big bubble. Okay? There is a big bubble underground. You drill into the big bubble, whoosh, there it is, right? Those are easy to discover, right? By geophysical exploration, they kick you in your eye, right? The smaller bubbles are more difficult. But of course, the gas, which is interspersed in shale layers, doesn't kick you, right? Just doesn't go out. You have to, several things have to happen for that. You have to start with horizontal drilling. We didn't know how to drill horizontally at all until, well, you know, we always drilled off because it's very difficult when you drill a very deep well to stay straight. So accidentally, we always drilled off vertical. But deliberate horizontal drilling, actually, it's one of the brilliant, you know, Russians invented so many things, I never credited for that, some of them spuriously, but some they really invented. So Russians were playing with it in the 1930s, didn't go far. We were playing with it in 40s, 50s, didn't go far. You know, it was only in 70s, 80s when it really started to come out, and then in 90s, just, you know, everybody was drilling horizontally. And we can drill now whichever way. We can drill like that, forget about horizontally. We can drill whichever way we drill. So when there is a seam to follow, we can follow that seam, right? And there is a shale seam and contains this natural gas. So all you have to do is to drill through it, not like that, but like that, and then fracture it, right? So you would release that natural gas in these interstices. And that's the whole secret, really, right? You drill wherever it takes you, and you fracture it, and the gas comes out, right? Now, even if the current estimates are exaggerated, because those of you know the story, you know that it's now from 20 years remaining reserves to 100 plus years, right? Even if it's double exaggerated, still, there is 50 years of relatively cheap natural gas. You don't have to know anything about natural gas, just check the last page of newspapers or any Bloomberg or whatever, and you see what has been happening to prices of natural gas in North America for the past 5 years, right? Nothing, right? They are low, they are slow, adjusted for inflation, they are lower, basically, than they've ever been, right? Because instead of running out of gas, we ran into gas, we ran into shale gas. And when you look at the map, shales are one of the most calm sedimentary rocks around. There are large chunks of North America underlain by shales. As a result of it, and moreover, we do the same with oil now. Our southern Manitoba, southern neighbor, North Dakota, is enjoying tremendous economic renaissance. Why? Because people don't know it. It's the fourth largest oil producer in the United States, following Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and California, fourth or fifth, right? Whatever now. I think it's now fourth, actually. Because they are doing the same thing in Bakken, both natural gas and crude oil, right? So you look at the world map, there is shales, plenty of shales in Europe, plenty of shales in Russia, which is giant territory, plenty of shales in China. So the shale gas story will be unfolding over the next several decades. You heard all these bad stories, you know, how just all this, you know, well waters on fire and, you know, water pollution. These are the problems of an early deployment. We can lick all of those. These are not insurmountable problems. We had a lot worse problems when we started the offshore. Only in 1947, we got the first platform out of the site of land. We were always drilling near shore, right? But only in 47 in the Gulf of Mexico, we were drilling, and still it was a very, very shallow water. Okay, out of sight of land, but very shallow water. Right now, we are producing more than a third of oil out of sight of land, and we drill like what? We drill, it's unbelievable. First, we don't drill. We sink the drill through 2 kilometers of water, 2.5, and then we'll drill another 2.5 or 3 kilometers, and then we get at it, and that's what we are producing now, really, right? Totally unthinkable in 1947. Right? And we can do it routinely now, okay? So, these problems which fractioning of shales is facing, they'll be solved, and they are being solved. And the reserves may be exaggerated. It may not be 120 years, but you know, certainly it's 40, 50, 60 years. And it's only the beginning, actually, because there is even more natural gas out there in methane hydrates, in clathrates, orders and orders of magnitude. And again, today you say, how do we get these things out? It's impossible. Well, you know, it was impossible in 47 to drill out of the side of land in 2 kilometers of water, right? So, because this is all based on things which we know how to do. We are just deploying things. And this is where these renewable things are somewhat different, because many of them are based on things which we know how to do, but many of them are different because we are dealing with different beasts, namely with, we are not dealing with fuels, unless you do the biofuels, right? But most of these are electricity deliveries. You take photovoltaic, solar, you take wind, you take global food market, right? And what doesn't go into food and feed that corn? Well, you know, it will raise the prices worldwide, as simple as that. To make it out of wheat in Canada is triply insane, because in Corn Belt, you plant your corn and you dump your Haber-Bosch ammonia on it, and then what? It's Corn Belt. 1.2 meters of rain, and it's just, you know, this tall, right? You harvest 10, 11, in Iowa, you harvest 12 tons per hectare. Our wheat in Manitoba, in a good year, is 2 tons per hectare, okay? 2 tons per hectare. So you start with 1/5 or 1/6 of the feedstock, right? So instead of being 0.4 watts per square meter, it's 0.0 something watts per square meter. It's just totally insane. And besides, we already subsidize this nonsense to the tune of close to $20 billion a year. $20 billion a year, we subsidize this nonsense. It's just simply a make-work project for farmers, nothing else, right? You know? So let's forget about biofuels, right? Of course, you have the alternative to plant fast-growing tree plantations. But you know, the trees will not grow fast when there is not enough rain, right? Okay? Or they will not grow fast if you not fertilize them. So you make basically a cropland out of trees. Not so cheap, not so simple, not so easy. And what are the countries with tremendous amount of surplus land to plant into trees, right? Besides Brazil, right? India doesn't have much surplus land. China doesn't have any surplus land. China's per capita availability of farmland is already less than Bangladesh, right? So China doesn't exactly have, you know, just millions of hectares to plant. Oh yes, they have millions of hectares, but check the map, right? In Xinjiang, right, and in Tibet, 5 kilometers above sea level, and in places where it doesn't rain for 30 years, right? So let's forget about biofuels. I should mention one more. This is irresistible thing. My Swedish friends, 7 years ago, they made a decision, a Nordic nation. Future of Sweden will be based on willows. We will have a rapidly growing willow plantations. Every little odd land in Sweden will be planted to willows, and we harvest them like crops on rotation every 15 years, right? That started in 1990. 2011, I don't have to tell you what percentage of Swedish energy is derived from willows, okay? So anytime you see some bio, saying biofuel, just, you know, turn the page or switch off the channel or whatever, right? You know, not going to happen. If it's going to happen, it will cost you $20 billion of subsidies and it will ruin the land. You know, you have to dump fertilizer, it will erode, it destroys the bio. It's just how anybody who is green could say anything good about biofuels, it totally eludes me, right? Now, we have our friendly wind turbines. There could be nothing better than wind turbines. They are friendly. They look beautiful on postcards. Unless you live close to it, right? It drives you nuts. Whoosh, whoosh. You just don't want to live to hear that noise. You know, just your blood pressure goes through the roof, literally, right? Okay. But all these Danes, they are living off them, right? Denmark is just everything is a wind turbine in Denmark. Well, why don't you look at the map and get some basic facts? Of course, it's easy to do in Denmark. Steady Atlantic regime, this westerly wind just blows all the time. One of the windiest places, you put it on the western shore, just blows. Denmark, it's a country, you know, fewer people than Toronto, really, right? It's a country which is interconnected like crazy. The north of it, Norwegian, with these beautiful fjords. The water falls down the fjord and they generate the cheapest hydroelectric in the world. There's only 4.5 million of them. They don't know what to do with it. So they sell it to EU, right? They will never become part of EU because they have to bail out Greece. They are rich, they are just living it up, really. So, but they just sell EU all that hydroelectric. Swedes, hydroelectric as well, right? And then south of it, Germans, all that coal, all that nuclear, until recently. Now Angela Merkel got berserk and decided to get rid of nuclear. Getting rid of more than about a quarter of your capacity just in 10 years, right? How they will get all that capacity from what? I don't know, you know, but it was politically correct things to do, really, right? Even Japanese haven't got so crazy, you know. Japanese are scaling down their nuclear plants, but they're not saying, you know, chuck it all out because there's lots of gigawatts installed in it. Anyway, so here is Denmark sitting between these people who have coal and nuclear and have hydro. If the wind doesn't blow, what do you do in Denmark? Just buy it of your neighbors. No problem whatsoever, right? Buy it in a quantity because you are small. You don't matter, right? You are like a big German city, really, right? So big deal, right? With whom I'm asking you is province I am living in interconnected? Well, yes, it's interconnected with Dakotas and Minnesota because we sell them that hydroelectricity, right? But they have nothing to sell us. So if the wind doesn't blow in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, we are cooked, right? We have nothing else, right? Nothing is interconnected in Canada. In Canada, there is no interconnection east and west. We are the only modern country in the world which is not interconnected. Russia is interconnected, not quite to Vladivostok, but far deep into Siberia. In Europe, we trade electricity like we trade, you know, whatever, dried plums. You know, you can from Poland to Portugal, from Sweden to Sicily. Just check the EU statistics, how much we trade electricity in Europe, all the time, all the time. Now, we trade electricity in this continent, but how do we do it? From BC to California, from Manitoba all the way to Nebraska, and from Quebec to New England and New York, right? But we don't talk to each other. It's Canada, right? Provinces are separate baronies. They never talk to each other, right? They hate each other. Interprovincial trade, no, no, that's forbidden, really, right? Okay. So we don't even have a juice line going this way, really, right? So if the wind doesn't blow, and there we have the problem with these things. So let me spend some on this obvious thing of intermittency and low power density. I had recently, in May, an article in American Scientist, and I was writing it in January, which tends to be the coldest period in Winnipeg. So I couldn't resist just looking out the window on the frozen Red River and this blue sky. I couldn't resist to put in this, you know, this so primitive, so trivial thing which people forget about. Why it's so cold in Saskatchewan and Manitoba and Nebraska and Dakotas and Minnesota in winter? Well, because there is something which we call Canadian high pressure cell. It sits there, not for one day, not for 2 days, but sometimes for 3 weeks, sometimes for 5 weeks, sometimes for 6 weeks. We had one period in 1979. Listen carefully to this. I will never forget about it. In 1979, we have 29 consecutive days in Winnipeg where our daily highs were below our normal overnight lows, okay? For 29 consecutive days, right? And this means what, that high pressure cell? No wind. This is why it's so cold, because there is no atmospheric mixing whatsoever, right? So what do I do when I erect my gigawatts of these beautiful wind turbines, right? And there is no wind for 29 consecutive days, really. And this is where people have to crank it up, really, right? This is where everyone wants to eat and where the lighting goes and cooking everything, really. So this is a serious problem. Large chunks of the world are struck by this period of long, intermittent nothing, really. Or too much of something. So Japan, okay, Fukushima, terrible thing, right? That would be nice. I would like to give a lecture on Fukushima. Fascinating stuff. I've just written on it recently. Many lessons to learn. Almost nothing to do with nuclear per se. Everything with human mismanagement, right? It was a first class of human mismanagement. They mismanaged everything they could, really, right? Plus, of course, they located the plant in a bad spot. They should have known. In Japan, we have markers. You can go on my website, these things are mentioned there myself. We have markers going back to 18th century, which totally mark the stone saying water rose that high in 17, whatever. We knew how, this is not the first tsunami where the water rose that high. These people ignore those markers well known. This is not like a place where we had, you know, Japan has a long and well-recorded history. So we just put these plants where we should have never put them, really. As simple as that, another story. Anyway, so Japan will just get out of nuclear, right? And they'll just erect these wind turbines. Well, this being Canada, half of the people went as jet teachers, right? Teachers of English in Japan, whatever, 30%. So you know what happens in Japan in summer, right? You cannot run your wind turbines in summer for large parts of Hawaii. Well, because it's a typhoon season, and it's simply a ripping wind of 150 kilometers per hour. And so what happens to these things? You have to shut them down, really, right? Your wind turbines have a very small window of opportunity. When there is no wind, they will not run. When there is too much wind, you don't want them to run because they would wrench themselves out of their foundations and flow into the universe freely, right? So, you know, so when there is a high typhoon season, and in Japan they come and go, you know, typhoon number one, number two, number three, right? Sometimes you can't fly off the island because, so what? You know, no generation. Then there are places like Sichuan province in China, the most populous province in China, cool 120 million people, right? Look at the map where Sichuan is. Totally surrounded by mountains. When we started to fly Landsat satellites in 1972, it took us 6 years to capture the first, because Landsat was overflying from north to south every place locally about 9:30 a.m. Eh? 9:30 a.m. for 6 years, the whole Sichuan Basin, 120 million people, always in clouds, fog, fog, fog. When there's a fog means what? No wind, right? No wind. This is a place where it's not just basically, you know, this is such a windless place, amazing, right? So how do you supply 120 million people in Sichuan when there's basically no wind for, you know, 3/4 of a year, almost no wind speeds there, okay? So large chunks of the world are totally unsuited for this because they have prolonged periods of calm or prolonged periods, no matter if it's high pressure or if it's the Sichuan is basing location, or just simply are simply too windy for their own good, really. the whole typhoon Asia, you know, Philippines, Taiwan, South China, Japan, you know, wind, just too much wind for too long. Now, we saw, this is so obvious, we don't have to talk about it today, right? Sun goes down, right? I mean, as simple as that. I'm always amazed that people just gloss over the fact that sun goes down. When sun goes down, I cannot generate, no matter how brilliant photovoltaic cells I have, right? Now, it wouldn't matter if while I am generating, I could store that electricity. But you know very well that we cannot store electricity on a gigawatt scale. Oh yes, we can. There is only one way how we can do it. Namely, somebody shouts. Pump storage, of course, you know, pump water storage, which is of course very expensive and you must be in a particular situation. Namely, like what? You are down here on the flatland, so there is your big city, zillion people just sucking that electricity, right? And next to you is a huge steep mountain, right? Going maybe like kilometer preferably, right? And that mountain has a plateau on the top. You just get some big bulldozers, make an artificial reservoir on top of that plateau, put just giant pipelines down, and at the bottom is sitting your big nuclear power station. You don't switch nuclear power station for the night when people go to sleep. They just have what we call the high load places. They have a load factor 90 to 95%. They work nonstop all the time. But what do you do with that juice at 2 a.m., right? Nobody needs it much, right? Also, probably half of you are 2 a.m. cruising internet, and you know, I'll get to it in a while. That's a different, I'll talk to you about, you know, how the course of consumption has changed over time. You know, we used to have a simple profile, you know, peaks and valleys. Now, basically, these are disappearing because the way you people live. So anyway, if I have an extra electricity, or there is a tremendous flood, and you know, I can open my sluice gate and generate in my hydro stations nonstop, I can use that cheap electricity or unwanted electricity, pump the water uphill, and when I need it at 4 p.m., whatever, boom, there it goes down, and within 30 seconds, I'm generating, right? We do have pump storages. Some of them actually on gigawatt scale, a little bit over 2 gigawatt, biggest one, one near Hong Kong for nuclear power plant, several of them in US. So we do have several of them on the order of 1 or 2 gigawatt, but generally, basically worldwide, this doesn't amount to, you know, like a very, very small fraction of global generation, much, much less than 1%, very small fraction. Plus, as I say, you know, if you are in a flat terrain, well, what do you do, right? Build an artificial mountain 1 kilometer tall and whatever. This is the only way how we can store electricity with a high cost of pumping it up, of course, so it's not a free cost, a huge cost on a gigawatt scale, or hundreds of megawatt scale. That's it, otherwise we can't. So when the sun goes down, that's it, your photovoltaic goes down. Now, let's go again to Sichuan or South China or Japan. What are my Japanese friends afraid of now? Well, of the summer. Because summer in Tokyo or Kyoto or Osaka are very, very humid and hot, 30, 32, and literally like 100% humidity, right? So what do? You crank up your air conditioning. It's not so easy to crank up your air conditioning when the country lost 30% of capacity, right? Because even the power plants which were working, okay, including the Hamaoka, which is closest to Tokyo, were shut down for fear that something might happen. So the country has now, whatever, 30% less capacity. I mean, the northern, you know, Kanto, Tohoku, that has 30% less capacity than it had a few months ago. Well, you know, there'll be less air conditioning, right? So Japanese are dreading, and of course they have buildings like this building, right? You can't open a window, really, right? These are these dumb modern buildings which cannot be naturally ventilated, right? And then you want to go home and you want to have half decent sleep. So when do people, when the climate oppressed masses in Asia, when do they crank up their air conditioners? Well, so they've got a half decent sleep overnight, right? How do you fuel it by photovoltaics? How do you fuel it? And this is the same thing which happens, and you live in this climate, so you know very well. What we have in winter, and which makes us very cold in central Canada, this is what you have in summer here, right? We call it what? Bermuda High, right? Europeans call it Azores High, the same system in summer, which presses on you here in July and August, and as a result, always what? You have hot and muggy days, sky is very hazy, sunshine is very indistinct, and it's 100% humidity, and 30% Celsius, and no wind, right? Everybody cranks up that air conditioning. No wind, photovoltaics is not good, air is polluted on top of it, of course, performance of cells go down in polluted air, so it goes. So there are some fundamental delivery problems because we need that electricity when we need it, We want to crank it up when we go to bed at 10 p.m., when we are in Tokyo or Taipei or Guangdong. And we want to have it in these cold places, and we want to have it in time when wind blows or wind doesn't blow. So there is a fundamental intermittency delivery problem for which we have no solution in terms of storage on multi-megawatt and gigawatt scale, for which the only solution is a perfect interconnection. Because there'll be always some place where it blows and where it shines, right? But you've got to be interconnected. In Europe, we are interconnected, but not sufficiently. In this continent, we are not interconnected at all. Okay? Now, let me turn to a fundamental problem which very few people stress when talking about energy transition. Our existing infrastructures are so awful you can't even imagine. Every 2 years, American Society of Civil Engineers does a report card on the state of American infrastructure. Read Canadian for the same thing. We are 51st state economically in that thing. So it's the same thing with us, really. What does infrastructure report card say? How many of you have seen the latest infrastructure report card in this? Nobody has seen infrastructure. That's amazing that one person would see two people. That's amazing. What does that card say as an overall grade point average? D, next. What does it say for electricity? D minus, whatever, doesn't matter. All of it is deep in D. There are only few things in C, right? Few things in C minus, really, right? Okay, that's it. So the latest one for 2009, there'll be a new one coming 2011, estimates that just to put it into a shape which would be like, you know, adequate shape for 1990 or 2000 level, $2.2 trillion. $2.2 trillion to bring our high voltage networks, our solar, The U.S. is every year now another $1.4 trillion sinking deeper into debt. U.S. deficit already $14.3 trillion. The accumulated uncovered obligations for Medicare, Medicaid, and social insurance, you go on the U.S. debt ticker clock now, is more than $110 trillion now, okay? $110 trillion. Right? So where is this money coming from just to spruce up our networks to the level they should have been by 1990 or 2000, right? Where are all these new infrastructures? Suppose, you know, this would be great, right? You know, suppose it blows in Quebec, right? It's totally quiet in Manitoba. Well, you know, just string it across, right? And bring the juice from Quebec to Manitoba. Well, you are talking about a cool what, half a trillion, something like that, right? For the network and so on. Europeans, of course, are thinking big now because Europe is cloudy. Only through subsidies you could achieve what Germans did. I still remember as is today when I got a phone call several years ago saying, could you comment on the world's biggest photovoltaic power plant? I say, where? They say, in Bavaria. I say, I grew up right next to there. You know, this is a place where you don't see sun in summer for 90 days, right? But of course, if you subsidize it to the hilt, well, they will build in a tunnel. Who cares, right? You know, they pay them, so they build it. So Germany now is a leader together with Spain of solar, but of course, to really to think big, they think of sunny places. So they have this giant project to put all these acres and, you know, hectares and hectares of solar photovoltaics and solar thermal in what? Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and bring it by super high voltage line to Europe. You've noticed recently that places like Tunisia and Libya and Egypt, they're not among the stablest places, really. And imagine that one juice line going there, right? This Al-Qaeda guy, he has to cut just slip one line and the whole EU is in darkness, really. So we have some real, real problems. In the US, it's the same thing. You know, people use calculations. Oh, you pave only this much of Arizona with photovoltaics, right? And this will serve the whole United States. Well, I ask you, do we have the high voltage lines radiating from Arizona to Seattle and Denver and Atlanta and New York, right? When the US infrastructure for high voltage transmission is D or D minus, right? So these things, again, they would take a while to build, and while being like what? Decades to build, right? So this is a simple message. No matter what you do, except installing a better furnace in your basement, which could be done in a decade, literally, for the entire population of the entire country, right? Or changing from, you know, lousy cars to decent cars, like changing from Escalade to Honda Civic, right? That could be done in a decade because average car now in North America lasts about 9 years, really, right? So these things, these transitions, we could do in a decade. But turning from coal and oil to wind and solar, keep thinking that all that energy to make that those wind and solar devices are fossil fuel energy anyway, right? This is not a question of decade. This is a question of generations. not a generation, 20, 25 years, but of generations, right? Last year, I had also a book called Energy Transition, so you can go into that book and you can look at some of these figures, which I calculated for all sorts of countries. For that reason, we've been doing, you know, this in past 30 years. That much coal, still that much coal 30 years later. That much oil, that much oil. That much natural gas, that much natural gas. Primary energy structure of all major economies, Russians, Indian, Chinese, Americans, hasn't changed for past 30 years, right? What we have is totally marginal. All these, you know, solar, wind, this is on the order, globally, on the order of 1%, or less than 1%, or 2%. Nationally, unless you are Denmark, you know, then it's bigger. But even then, it's not the same thing because people are making the comparison in the wrong units. And here we return to the distinction between energy and power. Irks me no end. What's the only way how people compare installment of solar and wind? In terms of actually, sorry, the electricity, in terms of installed power, peak solar installed or installed gigawatts or megawatts in wind, right? That's not the same because you cannot compare it with coal or oil or nuclear because these modes of electricity generation have fundamentally different capacity factors. If they would have capacity factors plus minus 5%, who cares? Apples and apples, just one apple is yellow, one apple is red, really, right? But here we are not even talking about apples and pears. We are talking about apples and guavas or apples and papayas, really, right? Because what is the typical, I already mentioned the figure for nuclear power stations, right? Including the Canadian ones, operating excellently now. 90 to 95% load factor. Just boom, they operate nonstop, right? Beautifully. Fossil fuel station, oil, coal, right? They operate at 70 load, 75% load. Right? Hydro, it depends, you know. It's very dry in China, so load factor will be low in China, right? Good load factor, you operate 40, 50, 60% of time, right? But even in Spain, solar power plant have a load factor. Would somebody know what Spanish photovoltaic plants have a load factor? 17%. Even in Spain, 17%, right? For all EU, for past decade, a beautiful study, for all EU, for past decade, including Denmark and all these windy places, wind factor, load factor, 25%, 21 to 25%, right? So basically, for every one unit in coal-fired or oil-fired power plant, you have to build 3 units in wind, and you have to build 5 units, or 4 units at least, in solar. So it's not the same thing. You have to compare on the basis of actually generated energy, electricity generation, not the installed capacity, right? Because of very different power factors, right? So just give me more wind, unless I'm living, you know, like a 300 meter from the giant thing. They are building them bigger and bigger. You know, we start with a few hundred kilowatts. Now we have them larger than like 3, 4, 5, 6 megawatts. These are giant things. Give me more wind, give me more solar. I'm all for all these things. But please don't have any illusions that it's coming to your neighborhood overwhelmingly at cheap price or even the paying for itself in no time in 10 years or 15 years. This is a long slog like all other previous energy transitions. And this one complicated by things like financial insolvency, low power density, intermittency, no end of problems. So it will take generations to accomplish. I quit at this point and attack me as much as you can.
Thank you very much, Václav. We have a lot to think about now. I think in our morning sessions, we tackle these very technical issues, and in our afternoon sessions, we have this chance to abstract a bit and really look at the complexity of the overall systems, and thank you for that. I think we have a lot to chew on. Let's turn to our audience, and I'm sure that many of you have questions that you want to ask, so again, I just remind you to please keep your questions concise because we have a short period of time. You can wave to Anton or to John over here.
Hi, my name is Kevin Riley. You talked a lot about the practical constraints on renewable energy systems, but are you aware of any studies of the theoretical constraints? So if you do a thermodynamic analysis of renewable energy systems, Is there something you can say about how likely it is to be sustainable over a long period?
Well, I already mentioned, when you look at photosynthesis, there it is. You know, we know that as of now or 5 years from now, we will not be able to increase the inherent efficiency of photosynthesis. That's the result of evolution over the past 3 billion years, right? The photosynthetic light system, really. And that is inherently very low efficiency. When you start with the solar energy coming in and the, so, you know, electromagnetic energy coming in and what comes out, the chemical energy in newly synthesized bonds, you are talking about 1%, 2%. For the whole ecosystem, maybe 3-4% for the most productive. So there is a theoretical limit right there, you know, which we can never. This is why biofuels are not such a great idea, because you are limited by it. So in that sense, you know, if you take a strictly theoretical approach to this, our best bet is to push what is best. And the best thing is, on the global average, there is 170 watts per square meter of solar radiation falling on a rotating sphere. Right? You take a solar constant 1366 divided by 4, right, area of sphere over circle, and you know, subtract albedo and absorption atmosphere, and you get 170 watts per square meter. So we will be able to increase our efficiency of converting that in cells to whatever, 50%. Well, we would be capturing on the order of 80, 90 watts per square meter. That would be greater, right? Then basically every square meter, you would need a little part of your roof to cover a house, really, right? Unlike this installation or whatever. So yes, theoretical constraints are very important because they should focus our resources and our attention to what has the best chance to succeed. And that's not biofuels, and that's not wind either, because wind per area works down to less than 1 watt per square meter. It's the photovoltaics we should concentrate on. And there is, as you know, there is a room there, because we've been crawling up, right, from less than 10% to 20%. Theoretically, now we are at 40% in the best whatever. So there is a room there, for sure.
Is there another question?
My name is Keshav. In your talk, you were describing many advances in oil drilling, for example, and with access to shale oil and shale gas. And you said that things that are not possible in 1947, now we do routinely. Do you foresee that the same kind of technological advance would be possible with, say, solar, so that we could imagine doing this, you know, 50 years from now, things that you can't imagine today?
Yes, of course, you know, look, as I mentioned, let's say, with wind, we are advancing. The first cut at the wind, which was in 1980s in California, these were like, you know, several hundred kilowatt machines. And they were like, they looked like from 19th century, these steel towers, and they were horribly inefficient. They were creaking and falling. Now we have these sleek things, which are, you know, 3, 4, 5 megawatts. So that's an order of magnitude jump right there, of course. And efficiency is increasing, whatever, everything. So yes, of course. But the thing is that in this case, you know, we are dealing with something which is naturally limited in terms of power density. The wind is simply not deliverable at more than few watts per square meter when you capture it over large territories. But at fuel, this is the beauty of fossil fuels. You get a kilogram of fossil fuels, right? And it's 30 for best coal, 42 megajoules per kilogram. It's such a concentrated fuel, and you get it out of, if the seam is thick, or if the giant reservoir is super giant like in Saudi Arabia, from a very small area, you get a huge flow of power. So this is where the constraint is. So yes, we are creeping up, and with solar cell as well, right? You know, theoretically, we are up to 40% and plus, right? It's a great advance, right? So yes, absolutely. You know, we'll have things which today seems unbelievable, right? But we will always deal with the fact that on a rotating sphere, on a planet 150 million kilometers away from sun, all you can get is 170 watts per square meter, really, right? And with the wind, it's the same thing. You know, if you capture it, and if you include, you know, wind, that's, it prorates to less than whatever, 1 or 2 watts per square meter. And it's even worse with things like, you know, ocean thermal difference, which is a huge thing around the globe, really, right? But what is the delta T there, right? Even in the warmest tropical oceans, it's like 27 degrees near the surface. And deep down, when you go on the thermocline, it's 4 degrees Celsius. So your delta T is 20 degrees Celsius plus. You cannot get much of power out of 20 degrees Celsius difference, right? That's why we super pressurize our power plants. So you get a difference of whatever, 500 degrees Celsius, right? Or Kelvin. So we are always limited with these things by the nature of these resources. Because what happened in fossil fuels, they've been concentrated, all these biofuels, they've been concentrated to this level, when it's just a kilo of it and bingo, right? 42 megajoules. That's incredible. So we will never equal the power density of fossil fuels with these things. So there are these natural limitations there.
And there was another question here.
Yeah, hi, my name is Nicola. So you're obviously embracing our fossil fuel society that we have. And so I'm just curious about the transition that you do see that's really in our efficiency and conservation in how we are and how we live as a society. So are you focusing, you think that that's going to be possible to us with more regulation by government and going in that stream? I'm just curious.
I'm not saying no to regulation, because we are regulated. Even if you don't like regulation, that doesn't matter if you like it or not. We are regulated already. And I always say, you know, one more regulation, what's the problem, really, right? When you apply for a building permit, you already have to jump through many, many hoops, really. I was lecturing in BC last 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago, and I discovered something I didn't know. I should have known. I didn't know it. They are the only jurisdiction in Canada, which is half sane. Well, thanks to the playing up to lumber industry. You have to have 2x6 in BC. Rest of the Canada, 2x4. This is one of the simplest things, how we could increase the insulation level by 50%, right? 2x6, 2x4, right? Why don't we have it, right? When we are exporting lumber, lumber's coming out of it. We say we don't have any market for lumber. Americans are not buying because they're not building houses. Well, why don't we order everybody to build 2x6 and put that extra 2 inches of fiberglass there and get extra 50% insulation in the wall, really? So, you know, this would be the simplest regulation. So I don't mean any kind of difficult, kind of complex regulation, just a simple common things like that, really. And we haven't done even those, really. Same with triple windows, my favorite constant complaints. There is no jurisdiction in Canada, of all places, mandating triple windows. Do you have triple windows in your house? No, of course you don't, right? This is a criminal thing. This is like making fuel out of food crop. Okay, not to have triple windows in Canada. You should not only have triple windows, you should have the windows which I have, with the gas in between, right? So it would insulate even more. Argon, whatever, there's enough rare gases which you put in between. If you don't have triple windows with gas in between, you are a criminal. You are destroying the biosphere, right? You cannot, you're not even brown, forget about green, right? You know, so these are the simple things. Remember, you know, you've got to have 2x6, you've got to have triple windows with gas, you've got to drive Honda Civic, you've got to have super insulated basement, right? You've got to do all these things, as simple as it is, right? And if you do all these things, well, then Canadian energy consumption per capita will be more like in civilized countries, like in France or Germany or Japan, right? Not like in this, you know, this mad land, you know. Think of it, right, that we consume nearly 400 gigajoules per year per capita, right? The global average is 60, eh? EU average is 150, France and Germany are 170 in Japan, right? And we are 380 or whatever. 370, and we are still inching up. Americans at least have leveled off for the past 20 years, okay? American consumption is going up because the population is increasing. They are one of the few affluent countries where there is still some birth rate. So, but in per capita terms, they leveled off. But in Canada, we are even inching in per capita. Well, you look at Toronto, you know why, right? Before long, Toronto will be in Manitoba, right? You know, so the distances people drive here and so on, right? So Canada is one country in the world where per capita consumption is still going up. People are building bigger houses, living farther away, and people fly more to gamble to Las Vegas, whatever they are spending their energy on, really, right? So there is no need for some dramatic regulations, just, you know, triple window, right? 2x6, don't fly to Las Vegas to spend money which you don't have, right? Simple things like that. Right?
And another
question
up
there. It's a big carbon footprint flying to Las Vegas, right?
So my name's John Walgate. Carbon dioxide has a very long lifetime in the atmosphere. So I'm wondering, are your efficiency savings that we'd all hope for of 40, 50, you know, some large number of percent, realistically going to make a significant change in the long-term climate progress, unless there is
some of these things are not so long-term. Some of these things, let's say, average car lasts 9 years, average furnace lasts 12 years, so some of these changes could be accomplished literally within a dozen years or a decade or 15 years. We should have done them long time ago. Imagine how much fuel we would have saved. It would have a rapid train link between Toronto and Montreal instead of this rapid air every 1 hour with these jetliners flying, right? Now, some of these things are really simple.
Sure, but if we continue to drive, even consuming half the amount of fuel, if the fossil fuel eventually gets burnt, then the carbon dioxide eventually gets into the atmosphere, where it will remain for 400 odd years. So do you see efficiency savings as buying time for a transition to a fossil fuel, severely fossil fuel restricted economy, using solar voltaics.
But you see, this may work and may not work depending, because look at China. Okay? China is the best example of how it doesn't work, really. Europe is a good example of how it has worked. Europeans got much more, you know, I say, you know, the average European refrigerator is much more efficient than our refrigerator. It's smaller too, same with washer, right? And most people in Europe do not have dryers, right? So that makes for a great deal of efficiency as well. You just hang it out, right? You know, if you are Italian, you always hang it out, right? You don't just churn it with natural gas inside, right? But China is a perfect example, it doesn't work. China is a country which had the fastest decline in energy intensity. You know what it is, right? The amount of energy per dollar of GDP or per yuan renminbi. So Chinese energy intensity has been plummeting like that. But their economy is growing by whatever, 9, 10%, 12% a year. As a result, total Chinese energy consumption has been skyrocketing. So when you are in a situation when the economy is growing rapidly, when you become the factory for the world, where everything you buy in Walmart is made in China, right? The fact that you are becoming more efficient than anybody ever, faster ever, doesn't help you still. They added 1 billion tons of coal in 5 years and another 1 billion in another almost 5 years, right? So they are now burning more than 3 billion tons of coal, and they are importing coal from Australia still. Okay? And they are about twice as much efficient for everything they do than they were 15 years or 20 years ago, really. So efficiency is not a solution if you're in a situation of rapid economic growth. Same goes for India, right? It goes for all countries, you know, where people are kind of, you know, aging, retiring, you know, they are content to go to Canary Islands to retire, and, but, you know, if you have this fast-growing thing, efficiency is not an answer. So what the answer is in those societies, we just have put a limit on consumption, which is very difficult to do, because they look at us and they say, why should I be limited to 70 gigajoules when those people are consuming 360 gigajoules, right? So even efficiency is not an answer. Nothing is an answer in long run. There's simply too many of us consuming too much. In long run, the only answer is less, less, less. And that's a message which nobody wants to hear, because this continent grew on what? More, more, more. Right?
Yes. Thanks. Kathy McClellan, back to the regulations issue. Are you for higher electricity prices?
Oh, absolutely.
If you're not for...
I'm for all prices. As I say, you know, my not a nightmare dream, I mean, it would be a nightmare. I shouldn't say I would like, but, you know, something like the end of Saudi royal family, okay? Which would bring the oil prices to like $500 a barrel overnight. Well, then we would have to do something finally. Because unless something, so this is a drastic, this is a rhetorical case, so to speak. To answer more rationally, yes. I am for upping the prices of every form of energy as much as we can, because you know what? What is the percentage of your disposable income you are paying for energy? You don't even know, but if you would calculate it, it's a 10%, something like that, right? 90% you pay for your SUVs and flights to Las Vegas and cottages in Muskoka and whatever, really, right? So energy is dirt cheap. The idea that oil is expensive is ridiculous. Oil is a lot cheaper than any mineral water you can buy, including the famous Dasani, which is the Lake Ontario water with added calcium sold by Coca-Cola, right? That's a lot, lot more expensive than crude oil from Middle East. Right? So increase the oil prices, doubling. Look, if you double everything we pay here, you still pay less than in Japan. So what's the big deal about moaning about $4 gasoline gas in US? Really? Well, we've been always paying in Japan $7. What's the big deal? And in Europe, in many countries, really. So, yes, increase the prices drastically. Triple them, quadruple them. That's for the start. Because I've shown it over decades that energy, basically consumption, is inelastic in North America, up to about doubling at 2.5. Only when you start tripling, people start doing less. You double price of anything, totally inelastic. People will drive more, right? So yes, much higher prices. Not just higher prices, much higher prices, multiple.
Hi, my name is Dorian. I was wondering what your opinion is on the oil sands here in Alberta, or over there in Alberta.
That's a tough one in the sense that that we are caught. Like it or not, I know you know your basic facts. Already more than 55% of all crude oil in Canada is coming from sands. Okay? Our classical oil, we are not running out, but you know, you will not go after this little bubble, really, right? There's lots of these bubbles left in Saskatchewan and Alberta, but you know, the old ones, the big, what we call the giant and super giant fields, the elephants of the business, you know, like the old Pembina, they are gone. You know, they are just declining very rapidly. So this is the only play in the town. However, we could use less of it, or they may be less need of it, because the rapid development was predicated on a massive increase of exports to US. Given the fractionation of natural shale gas in US, there may be less need for those exports. Because don't forget that practically, I keep repeating this until I'm hoarse, but people never listen. All you can do with crude oil, you can do with natural gas except for flying. It would have been half smart. We would have converted all fleet vehicles long time ago to natural gas. There is no reason why a single taxi, bus, milk truck, telephone, whatever, all of these things, all of these fleet vehicles should have been running on natural gas for past 3 decades or 4 decades, right? So given the fact that there is a more natural gas available domestically in the US, there'll be less need for exports of these things. So maybe we will not see such a rapid development of these things. Otherwise, seeing it, I tell you, I had an unbelievable opportunity to see it. A couple of years ago, I had to cancel my flight, and the only flight they had for me was going through Calgary instead of going through Toronto. And going the big circle from Frankfurt to Calgary, suddenly I look out of the window, and there I am, 10 kilometers hanging above the tar sands. To see it from the air from 10 kilometers, you don't want to see it. Because you see from that height, from 10 kilometers, and it's not huge, it's mind-boggling. It blows your, I just couldn't believe it. I'm neutral on these things. I mean, this is what we do, right? You know, to support the standard of living, we screw up the biosphere. That's what we do all the time. But to see it from these 10 kilometers, it's not a pretty picture. It's just incredible, right? It's a rape of the biosphere on a grand scale. But it's more than half of our oil. If you yank it out of Canadian economy, well, we'll go the way of Greece then. Because what else do we have besides our crude oil and natural gas? Lumber, nobody's building in the US, right? China gets their lumber from Africa now, they don't care for it. And to Europe, we never export anything to Europe. 87% of our exports go to US, and most of these exports are what? Natural gas, crude oil, and American-made cars in Ontario and Quebec, really, right? So, you know, we lose this crude oil, and what do we do, really, right? Our standard of living goes down by 25% just like that, right? So if you are willing to tolerate that, then kiss these things goodbye, really. But this is the future of Canada. We do not have enough liquid oil, classical liquid oil left, really. So, but we have, as they tirelessly say, we have more in the ground there than Saudi Arabia, right? Which is, of course, a theoretical, this is nonsense, doesn't make much sense, really, but we have plenty of it, right? So like it or not, if you are a Canadian, want to enjoy your close to 400 gigajoules per capita standard of living in Canada, you have to keep taking sense out of the ground, right? But as you know, good news is that the new generation coming in will be not taking out of the ground. Everything will be in situ recovery, right? Which is much less invasive, right? The old digging and squeezing method is gone. You just simply heat it, right, and recover it. So it's getting better in that sense too, right? And eventually you may get even just to your perfect control burning. We are getting better at it as well, right? So the news may not be that bad. You fly over that place 30 years from now, and there'll be just forest, just a little kind of, you know, like a natural gas handling plant, little footprint like 100 by 100 meters, and everything happening underground is just sucking pure natural gas out of it. I mean, pure out of it. So yes, it'll be better. Right? But right now, it just doesn't look good. Doesn't look good. Yeah.
Please join me in thanking Professor Smil for sharing his thoughts with us this afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our public lecture. Please watch for the agenda with Steve Paikin a few hours from now on TVO and WGSI.org. And as we wrap up and move outside, please note that you can purchase books at the Wordsworth Books table in the atrium, and join me in thanking Professor Smil one last time. Thanks. Thank you.